Blog Talk Radio.
Today on Backroom Politics, it's Tuesday. That means it's primary day somewhere. And today it's in Michigan and Arizona. Detailed coverage and analysis on these presidential primaries in these states. Also, special guest, Celicia Wilkins, political reporter for the Claremore Daily Progress in Oklahoma, talking about politics in the Sooner State. Is religion too separate from politics, or are we looking at a church and state merger? This and Tell Me a Story today on Backroom Politics. Celebrating his 19th birthday tomorrow. He is the longtime political insider on the Hill. He is the former floor chief for Gerald R. Ford and former vice president of the National Broadcasting Corporation for Government Affairs. He is the young and virile Bob. How you doing, Bob? Happy birthday tomorrow.
Well, I tell you, it's great to be 19.
To my right, he is the Vice President for China Affairs for the Eurasia Center. He is a bar-certified attorney in the District of Columbia in the great state of New York. He is Dr. Ralph Winnie. Ralph, welcome back.
Thanks, Justin. And I'm looking forward to voting in our state's first open caucus on March 13th.
Oh, very good, very good. And joining us for the first time, a new Democrat to the table. It'll be nice to have him here every week to kind of supplement the Democratic rantings of Congressman Al Swift, who is still somewhere south of the border, Arriba. But he is the longtime political insider in Vermont, Maryland, state federal politics. He's a former executive director of the Maryland Democratic Party. He served under many, many members of Congress, and he's now a public lobbyist here for Turman Associates. He is Carl Tooman. Carl, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us.
Glad to be here on primary day.
It is going to be fun. We're going to look forward to having you. Today in the 4:30 hour, just a quick announcement, we're going to have a special guest. Joining us is Celicia Wilkins. She is the political reporter for the Claremore Daily Progress out of Claremore, Oklahoma, which happens to be Will Rogers' home paper. He used to write for the Claremore Daily Progress, and that was his hometown out there in eastern Oklahoma. So we're going to find out what's going on out there in the Sooner State, but lots of news happening here politically. We're going to start off, obviously, with some breaking news. We're going to touch on it a little bit later, but breaking news coming out of Richmond. The Virginia State Legislature has voted into law, which will be signed by the governor of the Commonwealth of Virginia,
Bob McDonnell.
I'm having a day today already. It is a law that will require anybody seeking an abortion to have a sonogram done. We're going to touch on that later on the show, but that's big news coming out of Richmond. But the even bigger news today is the news about the two primaries. It's Tuesday. It's a presidential year. That means Tuesday is a primary day. Today it is in the great state of Michigan and the great state of Arizona. Michigan being Mitt Romney's hometown, and the tie to Romney is that Arizona, the big tie is, well, On Sunday, Governor Jan Brewer endorsed Mitt Romney, which kind of took everybody a surprise. First of all, let's talk at the larger scale politics of today's primaries. Bob, I'm going to start with you. What's the big takeaway from what has to happen today for the Republican Party to either show clear direction or start rallying up for a big fight down in Tampa?
Well, if Mitch Santorum wins, it will mean that it's sort of like, you know, another 90 days of snow or rain or whatever you want to say. It's going to be bad weather. It's going to be very difficult for Mr. Romney.
Are you calling Rick Santorum the Punxsutawney Phil of the Republican primary?
Yes, I am. Because if he wins, it's going to throw the whole primary subject really up the wall again. We're going to see. Remember that the states that are coming up next week in Super Tuesday, a number of them are in the South and are very conservative, much more conservative. There are also places where Mr. Gingrich could start coming back if possible. But so it's going to it could indicate that we're going to have a very long process. And there's nothing particularly wrong with a long process, but it can be difficult. And if Mr. Romney wins, I think he will win in Arizona, but if he does not win in his home state, quote-unquote, that's Michigan, it's going to raise serious questions of whether he can be the candidate.
And we're gonna talk about the five things to watch both in Michigan and in Arizona when we talk about the state-by-state primary race. But overall, Michigan has been an interesting play, particularly for both Romney and Santorum. The latest polls coming out of Michigan have Santorum and Romney in a statistical dead heat. Does that shock you in some way, Alan, or is that something that we should have expected almost?
Nothing shocks me this year. It was a bit of a surprise a few weeks ago when Santorum burst into a very clear, almost double-digit lead. Remember, this is a state where the primary voters tend to skew heavily conservative, but it's a small portion of the Republicans and a small portion of the voters in the state. Then you saw two things happen. One, the super PAC that supports Romney started aggressively advertising, talking about Santorum. Two, Santorum didn't do very well in the last debate. And three, Santorum has shot himself in the foot, arguably, in some ways that have gotten a lot of extra national media attention. So Romney has clawed his way back. So in the last 5 or 6 days, the race has tightened up. The momentum there was, if one can use the term momentum, because there's not a lot of momentum here, period. But the movement that started to move back towards Romney, it's going to be very close. It makes it interesting then to look at the whole day, because you've got Michigan where the delegates will be divvied up on a proportional basis, and the race is going to be close regardless. But in Arizona, it's winner take all. So you watched Romney in the last couple of days saying, "I hope to end up on Tuesday with more delegates than anybody else." He's looking pretty strong in Arizona, so that's a pretty safe bet.
Carl, Jennifer Granholm today on the Politico website in the Politico print edition wrote an op-ed saying basically, thanks GOP for moving too far right. She basically calls out the fact that, hey, move as far as you want to the right, because this is going to be a great thing for us as the Democratic Party. Do you agree with Governor Granholm on that one, or is she taking too much of a swing in the dark?
I agree with that. The only problem is that, from what I see, I think that the Democrats can get overconfident and too overconfident. And this is going to be a dog-eat-dog campaign when it comes to the general election, and we can't be that overconfident. I do think, though, that I understand that the Republican primary is very, very conservative, and all these folks are trying to go to the right to take in all these people. But I think in doing that, Rick Santorum and others, and with Governor McDonald today and other governors throughout the country, have really put a lot of different things in this race. This whole birth control thing is up front, and a lot of women are now saying, you know, do I really want these people or not? One of the things that really got to me, being a rabid Democrat and also somebody who campaigned with President Kennedy, is the fact that when you call President Kennedy out on the speech that he gave in September of 1960, I thought that was way, way off base.
Well, you know, one of the things that Governor Granholm called out is, and I'm going to quote her op-ed piece, she says, quote, "But to hear these candidates talk, you would think that they want to eliminate the federal government entirely and create 50 separate countries. Then we would be Europe, wouldn't we?" That's a pretty shocking statement coming from Governor Granholm, who, for the most part, has been looked at as a slightly moderate Democrat, not too far liberal, but enough liberal tones to at least get the message through. But she's a fairly middle-of-the-road centrist in many instances. That's a pretty big statement for her, don't you think?
It is a big statement, but when you look at what is being said on the campaign trail, and how everything should go from Washington to the states and this and that and the other, I mean, it really builds up her statement. And also, you know, the fact that here the President of the United States is trying to get us out of Afghanistan, is trying to tone down, and then all of a sudden you've got and trying to our people are trying to say to Israel, don't attack Iran, it's not, you know, don't do it. And then you've got the Republican candidates getting into foreign policy saying, we want to attack Iran, and we want to they shouldn't have a bomb, they shouldn't have nuclear things and things like that.
Now, wait a minute. Who has said we ought to attack Iran? You got to be careful here.
Who has?
Republican has said we have to attack Iran?
Well, I think Romney has come very close, if not saying...
He has not said that.
Okay. What about Santorum?
None of these guys have said that. They've talked a pretty hard line. I haven't heard anybody say we ought to attack Iran.
No.
You better be careful.
Okay.
Yeah. Well,
I'm going to check.
You check that. Yeah.
Okay.
For next week.
Ralph.
I think what's interesting is you see the establishment of the Republican Party coming out and saying not only Newt Gingrich, but now Rick Santorum will have an adverse impact on Republican candidates running for state and local office. So they're clearly worried about what a Santorum nomination means for our party. And that's why you have Jan Brewer and other establishment figures like Nikki Haley coming on board to support Romney.
I mean, well, let's talk about that for a second. You know, with a good handful of solid, highly popular governors such as a Nikki Haley, such as a Jan Brewer, who are coming out supporting Mitt Romney, Alan, are they following suit? Are they part of the traditional Republican Party? Especially when you look at a Nikki Haley who ran on a slightly Tea Party platform in her win in South Carolina.
You know, it's a reminder that what we used to think of as a Republican establishment that had some sway, some influence, people, especially in primaries, don't care very much what those folks say. And notwithstanding the fact, they are incumbents. Incumbents at any level of government are not all that popular, don't carry all that much sway. Now, it is significant to me in terms of the bigger picture that the people who are willing to endorse a candidate tend to endorse Romney. They have stayed away from Gingrich in droves. They have stayed away from Santorum in droves, including people in the House and Senate who have served with him. That's something that gets our attention, but the voters don't much care.
But Bob, Santorum's, you know, been called everything from more liberal than anybody else. I mean, some have said he's more liberal than Gingrich is liberal. He's done everything except sit on a couch with Nancy Pelosi in a TV ad. But he's coming across as this staunch conservative alternative to the moderate, if not liberal, New England Republican that is Mitt Romney. How does he displace that, or can he displace that vision, largely viewed by his former colleagues in the Senate and even those who knew him in the House?
Well, I'm not so sure that it's his, quote, political views on issues that it's too conservative, let's say. The thing that bothers me the most about Senator Santorum is that he is, in the last 10 days, become a religious zealot publicly. I mean, he's saying things that I think an awful lot of people question about policy issues and religion should be brought in. I mean, I think almost all Republican women must be gulping a little bit at some of the things he said. I think that the idea that religion should be front and center in decision making, I'm a Catholic, and I honor my religion and I try to live reasonably close to the precepts. It's not always easy, and I stumble and fall on more than one occasion. But nonetheless,
This
is a political conversation and nothing more.
We need to increase our listenership.
Oh, I'll have to make it up then.
Yeah. Wouldn't be the first time we've made up stuff on this show before.
I'm concerned about the fact that he is saying he's spending so much time talking about religion.
And it's no question he'd alienate moderates and independents if he received the nomination, let alone Republican women.
Well, but, one of the things also that Governor Granholm brings out in her op-ed piece in Politico, she says, quote, I mean, basically gives an invitation in writing saying, quote, to all moderate Republicans and independents, we'd like to welcome you to a new home, an expanded Democratic Party. We can learn from each other and you can help us add new sections to our big tent. It will be a beautiful, deep blue November in Michigan. Is that an invitation that is going to attract some of the moderate Republicans and the independents that everybody thought in the traditional Republican Party would center around Mitt Romney? Alan?
This is an invitation that is ill-timed. It strikes me as very odd that a piece like this from that voice, from a former Democratic governor, would start giving advice to Republican candidates. It's all odd. It's just a reminder that you got to be a little bit out there to get yourself into print.
Carl,
later this year, that depending on who the candidate is, they can try to make that point, and that's totally fine.
Carl,
I want to come back to Santorum. So we know when we look back at Santorum's record that there's some things that he is some votes he's having trouble explaining, whether it's supporting earmarks or voting for No Child Left Behind, taking one for the team, the sort of more moderate or liberal positions that he's now having to defend, but which in the world of Washington's you do this kind of stuff all the time, but the voter doesn't necessarily understand. So he's got these, if you will, these left of center votes that he's got to explain, and what I cannot for the life of me figure out is why he is not resisting the temptation to take some positions that are way out there on religion, on education, on women, on contraception. And I'm thinking maybe he thinks the way to counterbalance some of these issues he's having trouble explaining from the left side, he is way out on the fringe on the right side, and as I said last week, effectively, I think, disqualifying himself from having any chance of winning in a general election or being selected as a vice presidential candidate.
But Carl, I want to go back to what Governor Granholm said in her piece you know, the invitation to bring the Republicans. You've been around the state parties quite a bit. Is that an invitation that you think might attract some of the independents to maybe register Democrat to offset the Republican demagoguery that's being thrown around today?
I don't know if they would register as Democrats. I don't know if they would register as Democrats, but they might come over and swing over in the general election. I disagree with what I saw on TV last night was some ad, you know, asking the Democrats to go over and vote in the Republican primary. I think Republican primary should be the Republican primary, the Democratic primary, the Democratic primary, and you know, not play this game that they're trying to play of getting some Democrats to go vote for Republican.
Bob, let's talk about that for a quick second. We're going to bring that up when we talk about Michigan individually as the primary. But it was reported yesterday, and everybody, mm-hmm. I think, has heard the robocall where Senator Santorum basically put out a robocall to registered Democrats telling them to vote for Santorum to get away from getting Romney the nomination.
Yeah.
Is that a wise strategy, or is that's got to be sending the RNC and Reince Priebus up a wall?
Well, God, I'd hope so.
but then again, worried. This is a 2012.
Yeah.
This is a 2012 presidential race. That's got to be sending somebody up the wall.
Well, consider this. Number one, the chairman and the major party leaders, the senators and congressmen, the Speaker of the House, the minority leader in the Senate, you know, Santorum doesn't have any support among the leadership in the Republican Party. And remind yourself, the leadership of the Republican Party or the Democratic Party is not anointed. These are people who have worked their way up, spent a lot of time doing local work, and have run for election, and have been selected by their colleagues to be leaders in the party, because they are seen as good, solid people. None of them support Santorum. Santorum really can't get them any more upset with him, except by keeping doing things like this. I mean, but that's not going to change the fact that there are going to be there's a lot of people who obviously are listening to Santorum, and they're hearing a siren song that tends to seduce them a little bit. And I find that a little upsetting, because I am deeply concerned that anyone who carries the amount of baggage that Senator Santorum carries, both from the standpoint of the more liberal point of view, he's saying a lot of crazy things recently that he shouldn't be saying, I don't think. And secondly, he's got some baggage on some of the votes he's taken that makes some of the conservatives, as Alan mentioned, he makes some of the conservatives upset. So, you know, he's really, he's got an awful lot of baggage, and I doubt that any of the leadership in the Republican Party think any more of him or less of him, because they didn't think much of him to begin with.
Alan,
he desperately wants to win in Michigan. He knows he's got a real shot. This was another riverboat gamble to do this robocall, because you're going to take flack for it. It's going to, you know, take a little bit away if he does win, a little bit away from his victory. But if he wins, he wins, and that swamps all of the news. So he takes the chance, and we'll see what happens.
Yeah, but right now, Mitt Romney came out yesterday, especially, and started saying, hey, look, you know, Santorum's invoking dirty tricks. It's not real politics. It's just bad sportsmanship, almost cheating. Is he accurate, or is he just whining?
No,
it's,
whining?
He's
not so much whining as he's trying to undercut the impact if this should actually help push Santorum over the top.
Right.
Romney did a little bit of this up in New Hampshire. And when you have rules that are so fluid and change state to state, different kinds of strategies are applied depending upon what the rules are.
Ralph.
Romney's super PACs have gone negative on many of the other Republican candidates in the primary. So Romney can't come back and say that these are dirty tricks that Santorum is playing.
Bob.
This is not unique. He's not the first candidate. Santorum is not the first candidate to do this. He won't be the last. I think that it's It's maybe we might think if we're sitting back at an ivory tower, we might say, oh, isn't this too bad? Well, it's politics. I mean, it's above board. Everybody knows he's doing it. I mean, it's not as a big secret. So, you know, the reality is if that's what he wants to do, let's see what happens.
Carl?
The thing is, I think he's picked the wrong state to do it because I think Michigan is a fairly, the Democrats are fairly liberal. And for him to go over and try to get the Democrats to come over, I think, is, again, it's the wrong place to try to do that.
Where would be the right, I mean, is there a right place for him to try and do it?
As far as the Democratic Party is concerned, maybe some southern state or Texas or some other place like that. But I just don't think that Michigan is the right place to do this.
Alan?
Yeah, there's sort of two groups that are targets here. So you'd like the really clever left-leaning Democrats in Michigan to come over to just muck things up for the Republicans to keep Santorum alive and to harm Romney. So there's that element that appeals to, you know, a one slice potentially of Democrats. The group that Santorum is going after is not that group. The group he's going after are what we call the Reagan Democrats, the more conservative blue-collar Democrats, who might say...
The lunch pail Republicans.
Absolutely. Romney is not your guy. I'm your guy. Come on over and give me a break. If he can, you know, so there's sort of these two groups. I don't know if it'll work. He's going to, you know, because he gets hammered by Romney and others for letting, arguably, Democrats play a role in the nomination of a Republican candidate.
Bob.
There's an awful lot of union employees, a lot of people in Michigan, you know, the auto workers particularly.
Well, the UAW has traditionally been a conservative union, not unlike the leaders of the labor.
Remind yourself, Romney was against
the bailout.
So it's easy for the union people to encourage their guys to get out and blow up the Republican structure. They can, and it may well work, and it may well throw Romney a, you know, bad curve and hurt him substantially. But you know, listen, that's, you know, that's
it's
the way it goes.
Santorum's been accused of being a big union Republican. His record doesn't necessarily show it. One of the things that he kind of either demystified or bunked out was the idea that he was supportive of the coal workers and the steel workers union that he brought out in one of his statements this over the weekend was, you know, we bailed out the auto industry. He was supportive, arguably, of maybe bailing out the steel workers and the steel industry.
Sure.
Is there a certain level of hypocrisy in Senator Santorum?
National politics, it helps to be consistent, but it isn't required if you want to get involved. You don't have to be consistent. All you have to do is be able to talk about what you want to talk about and hope nobody else talks about part of your record that you don't want to talk about.
Alan?
To get elected to any office, particularly U.S. Senator from the state of Pennsylvania, you've got to appeal across the board. You've got to appeal to the lunch pail Republicans, and you've got to bring some Democrats and some independents over. And the unions have a lot of power in Pennsylvania, so he had to learn to deal with them and talk to them and support them in any number of ways.
Does that necessarily make him a big union Republican?
No, it means that he had to do what it took to get elected in Pennsylvania. Now, he didn't do so well last time out where he
lost
by 18 points. He was killed. It means that on certain issues, including right to work, he's on the wrong side of the party, but he was on the right side for his own ability to get elected and reelected several times in Pennsylvania. He's got to be held accountable for that. He's got to be able to explain that. But there's nothing surprising there, and I don't think it's hypocrisy to say that a guy, while he's senator from a particular state, tries to represent the interests of that state and realizes that the national mood is somewhat different, the national profile is somewhat different, and he's got to appeal in a broader way.
Okay, well, we're going to continue the discussion on the primaries, but when we come back, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to have Salisha Wilkin, who is the political reporter for the Claremore Daily Progress out in Oklahoma. We're going to talk a little bit of Sooner politics out there in the Midwest and get her take on a couple of races as well. This is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital. By the way, you can join the party. You can call in at 619-638-8477. Again, 619-638-8477. Stay with us. We'll be back in 2 minutes. Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. This is Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio. And joining us now from Claremore, Oklahoma, she's a political writer for the Claremore Daily Progress. Happens to be Will Rogers' hometown. Talk about a great, great, great American. But I'm talking about Will Rogers, and I guess we're also talking about Salisha, too. Salisha, thanks for joining us here on Backroom Politics. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Not a problem. Hey, Salisha, you know, we talk about the Northeast Corridor. We talk about the West Coast politics, but it seems like, you know, places like Oklahoma, Kansas, Missouri, you know, they seem to be kind of lost in the fray as far as some of the big political happenings that are going on out there. Does it make it any less important about what's happening out there in the Sooner State and about how it affects America as a whole politically?
Absolutely not. People here are very passionate about their politics. It is as much ingrained in them as their religion for many folks. And the political climate here in Oklahoma is one that would rival any other place in the country. Just because you're not hearing about it doesn't mean it's not happening.
you know, when we talk about Oklahoma politics, obviously the first name that comes up quite a bit is Tom Coburn, the senator from Oklahoma. How much is he either respected or vilified? And he's got a pretty high approval rating there inside the state, doesn't he?
He has a high approval rate. Yes, he does. That's true. But it's basically because people believe he is a champion for the people. He's someone that's actually willing to go and fight for what Oklahomans believe in. And being a predominantly conservative state, even the Democrats here in Oklahoma consider themselves to be conservative Democrats. So he's been one that, with especially the economic policies that he's tried to fight against, the pork and the extra, all the extra content in the bills. I mean, he's definitely been someone people here have looked up to.
When we talk about the larger political aspects, I mean, obviously, being a somewhat red state with some blue dog Democrats scattered amongst the area, when we talk about the presidential election, what's the feeling down there? How is the 2012 GOP primary playing out with folks down there in Oklahoma?
Well, I have a perfect example for you. Here in Rogers County, where our paper is, the Claremore Daily Progress, our local election board, they're actually recording record numbers of registrations, not only new registrations, but people changing their party affiliation. And I'm sure that that's somewhat normal as far as changing before primary, but people are coming in, and to quote just a few of them, I mean, their basic sentiment is, you know, President Obama needs to go. Many people come in and will flat out tell you, I've been a Democrat my entire life, but I'm not going to have my name associated with President Obama in any way, especially not on a ballot. I mean, people here are angry. They're fired up, and you have a complete switch from the way things used to be. Years ago here, if you were a Republican, a lot of times you wouldn't even bother going to vote because you didn't feel your vote would count. There were so many Democrats. But that's no longer the case. These people are coming out of the woodworks. They're changing their minds, and they're going red.
Is the state Democratic Party worried about it becoming a totally, totally red state? Are they doing anything to try and stop the hemorrhaging out there? Are there candidates out there that could possibly stop the hemorrhaging for them?
I don't see any candidates at this point that can stop the hemorrhaging, and I think that they're trying to appeal to the fact that the people that are moving to the Republican Party are more interested in joining the bandwagon, and they're more interested in the party affiliation and having a label than they are actually the values of the party. But when you actually talk to people, that's not what they're saying. They're saying, you know what, this system's broken. I've been going Democrat for so many years, and it's not working out for me. I'm going to change to something that might.
Hey, Salisha, talking about the presidential politics, so you guys down in Oklahoma have a presidential primary coming up next week on the 6th, I believe, correct?
That's correct, yes.
On the 6th, you've pretty much got the four-man race right now. Romney, the presumptive frontrunner nationally. Rick Santorum, who's managed to maintain stability in his campaign. And then you have Ron Paul and Newt Gingrich out there. Who's playing well down there? Is this a state that could go Santorum, or does Mitt Romney have some stroke?
I actually believe Santorum is going to pull this one off. People are overwhelmingly voting for him. His approval rating is up, I believe, 12 points in the last couple of weeks here in Oklahoma. People are really pushing for him, and I believe it's because he's really, I hate to use the word preaching, but he's really preaching the conservative values, and that's something that people here are wanting to get behind. There's even been local state legislation that's been going through. It's right in line with his policies as far as the abortion or being anti-abortion, and Oklahomans are really falling in line with that.
Is the Santorum camp increasing? Now, I mean, just for clarification, to let everybody know where Claremore is, you're in the 2nd Congressional District, which we'll talk about here in a couple of seconds, but you're pretty much in an area in that Congressional District that takes up half the state. Is that something where you're seeing a lot more churches, a lot more politics from the pulpit happening down there?
It's funny that you would mention that. I think generally people try to stay out of that, but you're actually getting mailers. Some of the churches here have actually sent out information to their congregation and encouraging them to vote for one candidate or another. I don't know how common that is up north, but here that's not completely out of the ordinary, but people are seeing more and more of that. And you also are seeing more people going next door to their neighbors and talking. You're having people that are picking up registration packets at the election board and taking them to people that maybe, you know, can't get there during their business hours to make sure that they get their registration filed. I mean, it's really spread. It's on fire here. I mean, if you guys could really have an opportunity to see that our political climate is just, it's much bigger than what people give Oklahoma credit for.
Wow. Alan Moore.
Yeah, so Lisa, you said something that got my attention when you said the churches are sending out packets of information encouraging them to vote for a candidate, Santorum in this particular case. Those folks better be careful or they're going to get themselves crossways with the IRS because they, unless they're careful, they're going to be violating the law that gives them tax-exempt status for donations. It's an interesting comment.
Well, and it's interesting, too, because they're very careful in the way that they do this. It's usually they'll promote the policies or the platform of a candidate and not so much their name. They're not name-dropping. But it's very clear when you get this kind of literature. It's very similar to what the Catholic Church has done recently, coming out in a stand against what President Obama has done. You'll see that kind of literature circulate here in Oklahoma.
Ralph Winnie.
Yes, Alicia, this is Ralph Winnie. Thank you for coming on our show. Two questions for you. As you know, the Vice President of China made a trip to Washington, D.C. A couple of weeks ago and wanted to get your perspective on what kind of impact has the issue of China had on the people of Oklahoma, the primary voters, and also the kind of rhetoric that's being spewed by the Republican candidates. And also, I'm sure you're following the issue with the Virginia legislature and the birth control issue here in D.C. How is that resonating among people of Oklahoma and the primary voters?
Well, first of all, people here, as far as the China issue is concerned, in District 2, especially in the area that I work in, people here are very concerned with what's going on in China because we have a major port. It's located, I would say, 20 minutes northeast of Tulsa, and if that helps you guys pinpoint it, but I was at a meeting just a couple days ago, and they've been talking about how they can make sure that their resources are there so that when more imports are coming in from China and other countries overseas, that they're ready to receive those goods and be able to pass them on. A part of their problem is that the infrastructure here in Oklahoma, a lot of the highway systems are in need of some repair, and the federal funding is just not there for those projects. And the state funding as well, and so they're looking at alternative ways, and waterways are one of the major pushes that they're trying to put into place to make sure that we're ready for, you know, those issues as they come along. And the second question you said was about birth control in the Virginia legislature. The state of Oklahoma just passed, or well, they haven't passed it yet, but they're in process of passing a legislation so that life begins at conception, and it will be a very controversial issue if they do pass it, and it goes. I'm sure that there will be some challenges that will go all the way to the Supreme Court with this. It's a law similar to the one that they have in Missouri where they're recognizing the life as it begins at conception. And, I mean, people here in Oklahoma, I am sure that there's people on both sides of this issue, but overall they're very strong, conservative, Christian people, and they really want to see all life being held as sacred and honored.
Now, Salisha, you know, looking at the Senate and how that's playing out there in Oklahoma with Jim Inhofe and Tom Coburn, both of them staunchly conservative Republicans. Coburn more vocal than Senator Inhofe is. How is Senator Inhofe's influence benefiting folks there in the 2nd Congressional District there in Oklahoma and Oklahoma as a whole?
Well, I think his influence is going to play heavily in the race for Borden's seat. I think people here are moving to those conservative values, even the Democrat Party. I mean, they've only got a couple candidates. The Republicans have 6 candidates in that race, and people are switching their point of view, and they're trying to get behind someone that they know is going to basically impact their bottom line. People are fed up with the economy. That's one of the top issues, and so is energy here, and especially with everything that's gone on with the Keystone Pipeline in the state of Oklahoma. People are very concerned about what the economic impact is going to be on our state. We've weathered the recession fairly well because of our resources here, but people are starting to think that if something big doesn't happen, if the right candidate doesn't get in office, that that's not going to be the case long term.
And so, Alicia, let's talk about, you mentioned Dan Boren in talking about the House of Representatives. Five congressional districts in Oklahoma, four of them are staunchly Republican. You've got one seat that's Democrat, and that's the seat being vacated by Congressman Dan Boren in your district. Who are the players right now that are running in the District 2 race?
Well, on the Democratic side, you have Rob Wallace, who's a former district attorney, and Wayne Harriman, who's a businessman. Both of those are candidates that are down from the southern part of the district. And the Republican side of the race, you have George Fott, who is a current state representative, Mark Wayne Mullen, who's a business owner, Wayne Pettigrew, who is a former state representative, Dustin Rowe, who's an attorney, and also known as the youngest mayor in the country. That's kind of his claim to fame. You have Dwayne Thompson, who's a pastor, and then you have Dakota Wood, who's retired Marine Corps, more than 20 years, I think, in the Marine Corps. So you have a kind of a variety of candidates. But I think the one of the big things for people to realize in this race is that there's no question that it's going to go red. And I'm not saying that as a slant towards the Democratic Party. It's because the numbers are there. The sheer registration numbers, the people that are coming in and saying, you know, there's no way I'm going to stick with the Democratic Party after what President Obama has done. You know, people are willing to go out on a limb and maybe even cross some lines that in the past they've not been comfortable with. You know, I was just talking to a woman yesterday, my neighbor, and she said, you know, I would rather die than vote for Boren. I'm glad he's not running. You know, they're just fed up, and that's really the sentiment across the state of Oklahoma.
Where's the big power base there in the second congressional district? We're talking about a congressional district that literally takes up more than a third of the state, the northern boundary up on Kansas, the eastern boundary of the district on the Missouri side, and the southern district on the Texas line. Where's the big center of power in that district? And is there a candidate that's from that center of base that's garnering that kind of maneuver or that kind of buzz, if you will?
Rogers County is the center, and Rogers County has the potential to carry the election. If a candidate were to get the majority of the votes here, they could potentially win the race with Rogers County alone. We do have one local candidate, which is Dakota Wood, the Marine that I talked to you about earlier. He's from Sequoia, which is just, I believe, 10 miles north of Claremore, and he's kind of our local hometown candidate. But, you know, we're trying to be as fair as possible with all the candidates and show, you know, be able to cover them equally. And I do believe that each of them have their strengths that they can offer anyone that's in the district. But right now, Dakota is a strong front runner, I would say, especially in Rogers County. He's definitely someone who has piqued interest of voters.
Wait, who's got the money right now in the last FEC runs?
Well, so far what I've heard, Mark Wayne Mullen, who is actually a business owner and a plumber of all things out of southern Oklahoma, and he's got the most exposure and he's raised the most funds. I would say George Fott's probably second to him in the race right now with funding. They have had some private resources that they've been able to pull from. Not all the candidates have tapped into a business or something like that. A lot of them are out hitting the trail just doing the standard fundraising for their candidacy.
Any of them, we had gotten word that, is it Mullen and Fout are largely self-funded. Do you know anything about that?
Very little. We've received some press releases from their own camps, and they've, you know, claimed of their fundraising. You know, I know that some of them have taken out loans against their businesses to run their campaign. But, you know, here in Rogers County, we're really trying to stay out of the fundraising and stick to the policies, stick to what their platform is and what their plans are for the future.
And who's coming away on that one? Who's got the substance down there that can possibly take it?
Again, I would have to go with Dakota Wood. He's definitely got the most experience. He can hit the ground running. He definitely has a clear plan for solving the economic issues that are happening. I mean, he's not a gentleman that you can, you know, get to know in 2 minutes or a soundbite, but he's definitely someone that's worth spending a little time finding out exactly where he stands on the issues, because he doesn't just offer a brief explanation. I mean, he goes in depth and he offers solutions for people. And I know I sound a bit like I'm advertising for Dakota. He is a local gentleman, but I've interviewed every single one of these candidates, and they all have something different that they can offer, but he does have the most experience, and even on paper you can see that with their different education levels of the candidates.
Well, let's talk about the economics of the district. When you talk about Oklahoma's second congressional district, it is one of the poorest per capita. I think the average annual salary in the second congressional district there in Oklahoma is somewhere around $24,000-$25,000. You had talked about you guys had you know, weathered the recession pretty well, but is that something that you're seeing not just the House candidates, but the folks that are here in Inhofe and Coburn? Are they taking note of the fact that, hey, this part of the state could use an economic thrust to build them out of that bottom half?
Well, I'm not sure exactly where they're standing on the issues right now, but I can tell you the hard numbers, and you're right about the average income for the district as a whole. But the interesting fact is that the north part of the district, areas north of I-40, if you're familiar with that, it's the highway that cuts the state in half, basically. You've got most of the major cities in the district, which are all, I would say, middle-sized cities, nothing even close to the size of Washington, D.C. Maybe a suburb there would be comparable. But basically, in Claremore, for instance, the average income, or the median income, I should say, is about $45,000 a year. And there's about 11% of people here that are below poverty level. But when you travel south to McAllister, which is the major city in the southern part of the district, you only have $36,000 for a median income and 19% below poverty level. And those are the biggest areas in the district. When you've got such a large portion of the district that's rural, you have very little industry in the southern part of the state compared to what you have in the northern side of the state. We're 20, 30 minutes from Tulsa, and you know they're an hour from Oklahoma City minimum. I mean, there's just it's a huge difference in the two areas, and you can't really even fairly compare the two. I know down south they have a large travel industry that they rely heavily on. So, I mean, if I were in Washington, I would be paying close attention to that. I would, you know, if people don't have money to take trips to, you know, if they don't have money to fill up their gas tank to go to work, they're certainly not going on vacation. And that's something that's going to hurt the southern part of the state if they don't do something about the economy.
Fantastic. Ralph.
Salisha, I just had one last question for you. You mentioned earlier that people are leaving the Democratic Party and are registering as Republicans because they don't like what Obama has done. You could summarize exactly what it is that Obama has done that these people are very upset about, and is the Democratic Party in Oklahoma trying to listen and sort of change their approach?
I think the biggest thing that people are complaining about here is the debt, the national debt, the stimulus packages that just haven't worked. You know, you have all of these projects here in Oklahoma, and there are reports that we're using federal stimulus money to do this project, but when it comes down to it, there's a lot of state and local funding that are having to go in to actually make these projects happen. They're not just straight-out gifts from the government, and even so, we all know that that comes at a price. And people here, that's one of their main focuses. When you have one of the lowest gas prices per gallon in this across the country, but yet people still can't afford, you know, to go to work, or if they do go to work, they're taking such a hit that, you know, they're possibly can't afford their health insurance, which would be the second issue here that is major for Oklahomans, and that's the Obamacare. People here, there are doctors that are already planning, you know, to decrease their practice size or maybe even quit altogether, because when the regulations go into full effect, there's not going to be any profit in it for them. It is a big concern for Oklahomans. There's a lot of health issues here in Oklahoma that we're trying to deal with, and we need the support of the federal government and not in a handout formation. We need to make sure that we have a government that's going to allow us to take care of our own and get back to those state rights. And that's basically what I'm hearing from people out on the street when I go and do stories or I'm talking to local officials. They're all echoing that same sentiment.
Hey, Salisha, kind of a side note there. I mean, Claremore being the home of Will Rogers, Will Rogers, obviously, his ghost has a huge presence in that part of the state. And obviously, the Claremore Progress being Will Rogers' home paper, is there a political influence that still is present with Will Rogers? I mean, he was largely viewed as a Democrat, but a blue dog Democrat at that. Do you see the influence of Will Rogers down there and the way that people think, the way that people vote, and the stances that they take?
I think the biggest influence, I would say, would just be the fact that people aren't afraid to ask those questions, and they're not afraid to speak their mind, and that's something that Will did very well. And it doesn't matter what party you're affiliated with, and even though a lot of people are changing their parties, you know, people aren't afraid to tell you what they think in Oklahoma. They're going to stand up for what they believe is right, and they're going to agree to disagree. If they don't, they're going to work out a solution. They're not going to sit there and bicker over the details. And that's one of the great things about being here in Oklahoma and the heartland is that, you know, people are friendly here, and they are willing to work out their differences.
Fantastic. Hey, Salisha, thanks a lot for joining us today on Backroom Politics. We appreciate it. We'd love to have you back on anytime.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that.
Salisha Wilkins from the Claremore Daily Progress down in Claremore, Oklahoma, joining us today, talking about Sooner State politics down there in the Midwest. Hey, by the way, it's happy hour, folks. So that means we're going to take a break. We're going to order our drink, cut a cigar, and go back talking presidential politics. We're going to talk about Michigan when we come back from the top of the hour. This is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. We'll be on. Stay with us. And we're live here at Shelley's Back Room, 1330 Wynoff Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. This is Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio. It's happy hour, folks, so that means we can look at Tanya. Can we order our drinks, madam, for happy hour? And we're going to open up the cigar humidors and take the show home. Yeah. But still a lot of ground we got to cover. Particularly, we've got to cover the primary news again. We're going to focus a little bit on Michigan. Michigan is right now in the throes of the Republican primary, as we covered before. Michigan's polls will close roughly in about 3 hours, according to our clocks. And we could see Rick Santorum steal from Mitt Romney his home state. We talked about it last week, but I want to reiterate because today is primary day in Michigan. Alan, how important is Mitt Romney, or how important is Michigan to Mitt Romney and the continuation of his campaign?
Well, as we said earlier when we were talking about this,
it's important, but there's nothing that's do or die at this phase. Romney will have a decent day. For him, he hopes to win them both. But even if he doesn't win Michigan, I'd be very surprised if he didn't win Arizona. If he lost Arizona and Michigan, it would be massively significant. But he'll presumably win Arizona fairly comfortably. May or may not win Michigan. He'll get a bunch of delegates. As I said earlier, he's kind of redefined success for the day and just says, I think I'll win more delegates today than anybody else, and that'll be good. He's trying to lower expectations.
How much does Mitt Romney have to win in Michigan for him to claim it as success? This is obviously not a state that 2 or 3 points is going to get him a lot of momentum, Bob.
Well, the only success, I mean, I think Alan said it very early in the program, you know, if you lose, you lose. If it's, you know, it's 36 to 35, you still lose. The fact of the matter is, it's his home state, and just the fact that it's his home state and he loses it is going to be it's going to have a significant impact. It's going to hurt him a lot. On the other hand, it certainly doesn't kill him.
Simple win just enough, or does he have to win by double digits for it to be a true victory?
I would say this, given the fact that 2 weeks ago he was 10, 12 points down. He's come back, I think, significantly. But the point is, if he loses it, the pundits are going to say, you know, this is a huge impact on the campaign, and people are going to be listening to that, and they're going to hear it, and they're going to start saying, well, maybe he's not the good candidate we might have thought he would be. Maybe he's not got what it takes. I don't know, but I got to say this. I think it's going to be very close either way, and I think that if he loses it, it's going to have a significant impact on his campaign. Although I must say this, Super Tuesday being what it is, he'll come out of Super Tuesday with more delegates on Super Tuesday than any other candidate, unless something really goes wrong and he really gets beat badly.
Talking about Mitt Romney.
Yeah.
Okay. Carl, how much did... especially with the legacy of his father being governor in the heyday of the auto industry in Detroit, how much did his comments about letting Detroit go bankrupt hurt him in the eyes of not only the Republican Party in Michigan, but the general electorate in Michigan and the general electorate nationwide?
I think it was a disaster when he made the statement. I can't understand someone whose father was in the auto business, very, very successful, and the auto business was in bad shape in this country, how you could say, let it go. It seems to me that it was a little bit of we can let it go and we can diffuse the union influence in Michigan. I think it was a mistake.
Alan.
Yeah, let's just remember the facts. He wrote an op-ed that some op-ed writer said
let Detroit go bankrupt. He did not say let Detroit go bankrupt. He never said that. Unfortunately, that was the title of the op-ed he wrote, where he said the federal government should not step in. This the auto companies that can't survive, and it turned out there were two, not three, GM and Chrysler. Ford said, we're going it alone. That they should go into what's called a managed bankruptcy. Companies go into bankruptcy. They don't have to pay all of their debts. They can continue to restructure and work. Now, what the administration chose to do was take a different path to a managed bankruptcy. What they did is they put some bridge financing into those companies. That was the controversy. Should the feds put in the bridge financing? The administration decided this was a legitimate position for them to take, that a managed bankruptcy that we would normally see in a fairly good economy wouldn't work. There would be no financing, and liquidation might occur. That would have been a disaster, but that's not what Romney said. Romney said managed bankruptcy, keep the government out of it.
And by the way, wasn't that a ball that got rolling underneath the Bush administration that carried over into Obama?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Bush administration was very open to this possibility of providing some governmental funding. I think it's just unfortunate, and you know, this is kind of part of this amazing string of luck that the president is still having, where the Republicans are shooting with both barrels. They're shooting with one gun at each other, with the other gun at their own feet.
Right.
So every one of these guys has done damage to himself, and they're harming each other, and Obama's standing off to the side enjoying it and watching it. But I think in this particular case, the irony is that the two guys, that is Obama on the one hand and then Romney and Santorum on the other side, have said managed bankruptcy was the right way. Now, what Romney is accusing the president of doing, and I think there's some argument for this, is that when they stepped in, they had a lot of power to structure the bankruptcy itself, and that they tilted heavily towards existing workers and didn't make the workers take as large a hit as they might have had the government not stepped in. That's an interesting argument.
But your comment saying, Mitt did not say let Detroit go bankrupt. I mean, reading between the lines, Mitt Romney in his Wall Street Journal piece that everybody's claiming, he said let Detroit go bankrupt. Yeah. In the Wall Street Journal page, was not a fan of the federal government and the bridge financing and the managed bankruptcies, the way it was proposed to the bankruptcy courts. I mean, basically, reading between the lines and paraphrasing is saying let GM and Chrysler go into bankruptcy. One could take certain influx and say, well, he basically wants Detroit to go bankrupt and let them fix themselves. It's a free economy. Is that inaccurate?
Yeah, it's not. I mean, I resist this notion of Detroit, which is a great big city, highly dependent on the auto industry, but it's just different to say let these auto companies go into bankruptcy, which is what they did. It's just that they took a path to bankruptcy in which the federal government got involved in a very, very big way.
Bob.
I couldn't agree more with Alan. I mean, I think it's exactly the truth. The problem is that once a story, once something gets out, Romney says let them go belly up, it sticks. It's hard to read between the lines. It's hard for truth to catch up. That's what happens. And I'm sure that that's one of the biggest problems he's got right now in Michigan.
Carl.
One of the things that they were talking about when all this was happening is the collateral effect that it would have on the suppliers of the auto industry. That if they let the auto industry go bankrupt, the tool people could go bankrupt and other people could go bankrupt, and there would be a lot of unemployment spread throughout the country.
But Alan,
the companies went bankrupt. GM and Chrysler went bankrupt.
They both filed Chapter 11.
What happened was that they were able to go into managed bankruptcy, which is going bankrupt, in a way that they had this
financial underpinning from the federal government that allowed them to do that, it might have made all of the difference. I don't know. That's a different kind of debate.
Bob.
But the big difference was, instead of going into a managed bankruptcy and having private enterprise money come in to help their restructuring, the government came in with government money and, as Alan says appropriately, made a much more favorable structuring to benefit the union members as opposed to what you might normally get in a business-structured, managed bankruptcy.
But did it really help the union? I mean,
sure
there are some that are saying that as much pain or as much as the auto industry had to give up, the UAW was there at the table saying, hey, look, we're willing to cut ourselves just to make this thing continue to flow.
Well, the government comes in. The unions start talking to the government. And let's work a deal out. Management's talking to the government. And basically, they cut a deal. There's nothing wrong with that. I mean, literally, look, let's face it. The two companies are doing well right now. They've come back. They're both producing good automobiles. They're selling them. They're back. They're doing a lot. They're doing a lot better than they were before. That's a good thing. I mean, my God, we need a vibrant manufacturing operation in this country, and automobiles is one of the half dozen largest manufacturing operations in this country.
Well, we need that.
We
talked about Mitt Romney's flubs in Michigan. The other one we have to talk about is Rick Santorum's flubs. The biggest one coming by him calling the president a snob by suggesting that the idea of sending every kid to college makes the president a snob for him saying that. Well, there's a lot of hypocrisy in that, Ralph.
I mean, I went to the same high school as Obama, and at our school, everyone was geared to going to college. But at the same
time, you snob.
We are not.
Snob.
We have
no idea.
You're
such a snob.
Go on, Ralph.
But, you know, you're on a track to college. It was a college prep school. But at the same time, everyone recognized that there were always the option if you wanted to go to a community college.
Community college is still a college.
Right.
Half of that name is community college.
But what Santorum needed to say was that it's important to encourage people to get into a vocation, into a trade school, if they're not necessarily cut out to go to college.
Alan?
It's interesting. Something over 90% of Americans want their kid to be able to go to college. This is a dream that virtually everybody has. Now, having said that, only about 30% of Americans are graduates of four-year colleges. Here is a case where Santorum is trying to create an issue that he thinks will resonate by ascribing to the president views that the president clearly was not expressing. The president was not putting down people who don't get to go to college, and that's in effect what Santorum was accusing him of, and hence this sort of snob business. That's not what the president was doing. It's putting words into the president's mouth. It's another case of Santorum, unfortunately, because I'm the only guy around here who feels like I've sort of known him and have had good experiences, good positive experiences with him in the Senate. But he is just out there creating stuff that doesn't exist. And he got himself into trouble, and then he had to backpedal, which he's having to do over and over again on issue after issue.
Just for time constraints, I want to bring in the Arizona factor right now. And the factor I'm about to bring up is a factor both in Michigan, but largely in Arizona as well, and that's the older Michigan votes. Our friends at Politico bring up the fact that the older Michigan voters are going to have an effect, as they will in Arizona, a huge retirement community or a huge retired electoral base down in Arizona. But even in Michigan, there are older Michigan voters that remember the greatness of the Romney family when they were in Lansing and they had the governor's mansion. Is that a big factor that could help Romney, or is that too far gone and people just have a short memory? Bob? I mean, you're the youngest one at the table right now, being only 19, but you've had a long-term service inside government.
It's amazing what you can learn in 19 birthdays if they cover 76 years.
But
those are dog years, right?
I'm wagging my tail, baby.
But how much are the older voters going to get out and support Romney just based on the fact that his dad was so great in that state?
There are obviously some who will. I think what is going to be more valuable to Romney than anything else is there's been, in many states, they had early voting before Santorum got up there and before Santorum made his, 10 days or 20, two, 3 weeks ago, but before he got really hot. I think there's maybe two out of three of the really early voters are probably voting for Romney because of some part of what you said. And secondly, because at that point he was obviously the leader, as before, Santorum won three elections in a row. So that's a big help there. But most of the voters are the guys and gals who go on the day of the election, and Santorum is probably going to win that.
Alan,
I'm recalling that no one has made reference to the fact that George Romney, who of course was a governor of Michigan and also a auto executive, the company he ran was American Motors,
which, by the way, no longer a bankrupt big,
probably went into a managed bankruptcy at some point. But didn't American Motors make the Jeep? Isn't that the only thing that survived from American Motors?
That's the reason Chrysler bought them.
Became part of Chrysler, and it's the main reason that Chrysler still exists.
Yeah. Right.
Because of the Jeep, not because of the other Chrysler products.
Right.
That and the bailout.
Right. But let's look at that Arizona a little bit. Carl, how influential is Jan Brewer's endorsement going to be for Mitt Romney? Is that going to help him carry? Right now, the latest polls we have double-digit leads for Romney over Santorum and the other two candidates, being Gingrich and Paul. Is Governor Brewer's influence going to help him just lock down Arizona as a win?
I don't think so.
Really?
I don't think so, because Arizona, I'm not sure the complexity of Arizona and her influence, et cetera. I think the negatives come along with that. I was surprised when she did it, but I think, again, it's certain segment of the Republican Party coming in and saying, we can't have Santorum, we can't have Gingrich, we're not going to have Paul, we got to have Romney. And it's a shot in the dark.
Bob, is Jan Brewer going to be an influence, you think?
I think, it never hurts to have the governor of the state, if the governor is popular, to support you. The question is, how popular is the governor? I think she's probably still got a reasonably good base, but probably she's done a few things recently that have, obviously raised some questions. But the fact of the matter is, she's the governor, and I think even without her support, I think Mr. Romney would have won the state. I think he will win the state, and I think he'll win it easily.
There's a very strong LDS base in the Republican primary in Arizona that's going to favor Romney.
Alan.
Well, and the other thing that helps him in Arizona is that there's a lot of absentee voting and a lot of votes have already been cast, and that's where organization really helps you. Romney from the beginning has had a strong organization there, and a lot of votes have already been cast, presumably heavily weighted towards Romney. So, and Romney knew that Arizona and his people knew early on that this was a winner-take-all primary, so you wanted to do well there. You wanted to invest some resources and be organized. I think that Michigan and Arizona have about the same number of votes. Maybe one more in Michigan than in Arizona, because Arizona's grown so much. So Romney wins Arizona, and he wins a handful of. Even if he loses in Michigan, he ends up with a lot more electoral votes on the day.
A lot more
delegate votes.
Which is why he has been saying, "I'm pretty sure I'm going to come out of today with more votes than anybody else."
Yeah. Right. Well, bottom line here, because I want to take a break, and then we're going to go into a much larger issue that has been dominating a lot of the press, not only here inside the Beltway, but nationwide. But bottom line here, we've tried to handicap these primaries before, and we've had our rear ends handed to us. We're going to try it again. Who wins Arizona and Michigan, Alan?
Well, Romney wins Arizona, and on the Michigan, you got to pick one. So I'm going to just assume that this closing momentum will squeeze out a victory for Romney. But, boy, I wouldn't bet not only the ranch, I wouldn't bet the outhouse on
it. Bob?
Romney will win Arizona easily, and I think it'll be a tie in Michigan.
Carl?
I think Romney in Arizona. And the thing that's different about Michigan is you've got a delegate count and you've got a popular vote count. And a lot of people are saying, well, Romney might win the popular vote, but Santorum's going to win the delegate vote. So.
Interesting take. Ralph?
I think Romney's going to win Arizona. As far as Michigan, too close to call, but I think Romney ekes it out fairly.
Romney wins Arizona handily. Romney will surprise everybody. I think the ghost of his father's there. I think he might pull it up 9 points or better. Yeah, I'm going out on a limb. My record isn't exactly Jimmy the Greek.
I'll bet you $10,000. I'll bet you
$10,000. Wow.
That's a big limb, too.
Stop. Anyway, when we come back, we're going to talk about a very serious issue with the news coming out of Richmond today, with the rhetoric coming out of, in particular, the Santorum camp, and then the aftermath of the Secretary Sebelius announcement about the religious organizations regarding birth control. Religion has become a huge issue in this year's presidential campaign and in other areas. Want to talk about how religion and state are starting to merge, or are we trying to really keep them separate? Big debate coming up here, folks. Stay with us. It'll be interesting. This is Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Of the sun and west of the moon, we'll build a dream house of love. The moon, dear.
Right. And we're back here in Chili's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. This is Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio. Talking about a really interesting subject that's coming out right now, and it's garnering a lot of attention. For those of you who did not see the breaking news coming out of Richmond, Virginia, the state legislature in Virginia has approved a measure that requires all abortions to have sonograms performed before the procedure. This is just the latest in many, many other religious-based laws and policies coming out of Washington, D.C. and surrounding states regarding religion, and it calls into question how embedded is religion in the state now, or are we maintaining a separation? Bob, you and I talked before the show, and this is something that is just, I guess, grating on you almost a little bit.
Yeah.
For full disclosure,
I'm an
avid Irish Catholic.
I'm an Irish Catholic.
And as such, you've seen a lot of the policy retorts coming out of the church, as well as what's been coming out of government. How much is religion bleeding into the state, or are we really keeping a separation going?
Well, my view is that we're getting into ground that probably we would be better off not getting into. That's my feeling. You know, the way the Constitution is written, the First Amendment, you know, protects freedom of religion, right to practice your religion anyway, but it doesn't suggest that the government is going to, you know, is going to have an oversight, so to speak. The fact that I am a Catholic has almost nothing to do with what I'm about to say, because my view is that the idea, you know, there are so many different faiths in this country, so many different views of what my dogma is, what your dogma is, how you look at certain things. And the genius of our system is that all religions can exercise their rights to believe what they want to believe and can speak up for whatever they want to say, but none of it is part of the government policy. It's the religious beliefs, and that's a totally different thing. And I am uncomfortable with the idea that, and in this case, it seems to be more the Republican, Protestant, evangelical group at the moment that is having the most impact. And while I honor and I would defend forever their right to have their view, I question whether it is good for the country to have state legislatures, national policy, whatever, tend to follow or limit or impose upon or follow any religious belief that isn't antithetical to American freedom. And I think we're getting a little bit we're crossing the line sometimes.
But Alan, you know, it's funny, you know, listening to what Bob's saying, and then we turn around back in 1960, John F. Kennedy, there was a strong anti-Catholic sentiment going around the country saying that if John F. Kennedy, a Catholic, gets elected into the White House, that he's just going to be a political conduit for Rome and the Vatican. He gave a very, very definitive and strong speech stating his pledge and his promise to separate, you know, basically saying, and I'm paraphrasing, his ideals as a Catholic when it goes to his faith will not influence his judgment as President of the United States, keeping and bound to keep state and religion separate. Then we see Rick Santorum saying that he was ready to throw up when he heard that, and he's a Catholic himself. What message is that sending to the general electorate and to the Americans as a whole?
it's sending a message that Santorum is brain disconnects from reality from time to time. Why in the world he would want to take on, you know, use these sort of graphic terms of throwing up, a speech that John Kennedy gave in 1960 to try to calm down the populace and the fear that he was some kind of a papist who would be taking direction from Rome on major decisions is just odd and bizarre. Having said that, I also remember not very many years ago, eight short years ago, when John Kerry, the candidate against George Bush, against a highly extraordinarily vulnerable and unpopular George Bush, turned out to be a grotesquely weak candidate, said on these issues of abortion and abortion rights that he didn't think that his religion should have an impact on governmental policy. Well, who says that you have to be pro or anti-choice on the basis of your religion? There are many Catholics who are pro-choice, and there are many non-Catholics who are pro-life. There are a lot of issues here that may be influenced on an individual basis by religion, but that doesn't mean that because you have a particular view, it is because of your religion. I think that there's two different issues here. The First Amendment basically says organized religion shall not control the state, and the state shall not control organized religion. That does not mean that a politician who has a view, possibly grounded in his religion, but possibly not, should simply abandon that view when it comes to what he or she believes on public policy. And this
is not so you believe, let me get this straight, you believe that he didn't say it correctly, but the sentiment of Rick Santorum has some legitimacy?
No, I think that he should never have picked this fight, period. And I don't think that A and B, I don't see anything wrong with what President Kennedy said back in the time when he said, I'm not controlled by my religion. That doesn't mean he's not informed by his entire world experience, including the church that he grew up in.
But we're seeing bleed over right now. I mean, basically, the right to life, whether you're right to life or pro-choice, is an individual matter. But we're seeing the religious right, the religious base, starting to influence state rule, which Roe v. Wade basically gave them that license to do. We're seeing a lot more religion being infused in a lot of these state laws, i.e., what has happened in Virginia. Where does the separation come out?
Wait. You go ahead.
Bob, I want to hear your side, and I'll go back to Alan.
Well, you know, I look at it this way. I don't think a sonogram, which is what we're talking about in the Virginia situation,
right,
is required.
It is according to the law now
in Virginia.
Yeah.
No, it isn't yet because
the governor signed the law by the governor.
No,
right.
It hasn't gone back to the House.
Right.
Yeah.
But
passed the Senate.
It's going to be signed.
Oh, it will
the
be.
Law.
It will
yeah.
be.
Okay.
Yeah. And I'm not concerned about medical procedures that are necessary for the health of the woman. That's one thing. But I'm not sure a sonogram is something and I'm not knowledgeable enough to be an expert. I don't even pretend to know what I'm talking about, which means I'll talk for a long time. Now, the point is, I don't know, but I don't think that a legislature is particularly the best place to discuss these issues. I would much prefer to see that these kinds of questions, whether something is or is not, should or should not be required medically, I would think that the best thing to do is have some kind of a medical board make that decision. Politicians are going to make it based
on
what
they're... Well, you'd expect the AMA, for example, to chime in and saying, yes, in order to truly protect the individual, in order to terminate a pregnancy, there should be a sonogram for these health reasons.
Yeah,
I agree.
That makes
sense. But can you legitimately right now tell me that there is not religious infusion in that law?
No, I think there is. And that's what fundamentally aggravates me. I don't think those things are, that's a good way to legislate. And I think it probably gets pretty damn close to getting involved in First Amendment rights.
And when you look at Rick Santorum, his political and religious views are totally intertwined, cannot seem to separate. And that's very disturbing because you have to be able to govern with a degree of impartiality. When we're looking at this law in Virginia, it's very frightening because now the government is starting to get involved in your personal life and how you decide on whether you're going to have your pregnancy terminated or not. And it's very dangerous.
Carl.
Well, you've got other states like Maryland, where the governor has just signed a law on same-sex marriage, and you know, it galls me, and it galls me because I love Christmas, but it galls me when people will file a lawsuit to have the crush taken out in front of a church, or have Christmas lights darkened and all that. And I think in Virginia, what happened there is, to me, it's a disgrace. And I think what it's going to do ultimately, it might be a religious thing, but it's going to force a lot of women to say, forget it. I don't want these people. I don't like these people. The women look at this as a attack on women's health. And no matter what you say, religion might be part of it, but that's how they look at this thing.
Alan.
You know, it troubles me that we get into this box of saying that this particular issue relating to abortion and a procedure that a woman seeking an abortion has to have is somehow a religious issue, because there are Catholics who are for it and against it. There are evangelicals who are for it and against it. The fact of the matter is that abortion is unique in our world. We have the ability to allow people to make a decision about a pregnancy early on and do it in a pretty safe way from a health standpoint. And we can look around the world and see where abortion is almost an amoral issue, an issue that abortion on demand should be allowed. Now, a lot of us...
Hold on. Let's just jump in real quick. Let me ask this question. When we talk about the abortion issue, okay, and I want to tie this back to the HHS decision that Secretary Sebelius put out. When you talk about the abortion issue, pro-life organizations across the country have said that we are going to make it literally impossible, whether it be administratively, whether it be procedurally, for a woman to terminate a pregnancy. And yet we see the Catholic Church fighting about the contraception issue regarding the HHS Secretary Sebelius move to make them pay for contraception, have it available.
Look, it's apples and oranges.
Why?
It happens. They both deal with reproductive health, which is why we mix them up. Abortion, in the views of those who oppose abortion, is murder. I'm not saying it's murder. I'm simply saying that the view of those who oppose abortion in all cases or in most cases see it as murder. It may or may not be part of their religion. It doesn't have to be. So state after state has put all kinds of different restrictions.
Wait,
no, just a minute.
Wait,
many states have put lots of restrictions on what it takes to get an abortion. You got to get parental permission if it's a young girl. You got to do all sorts of things. I don't know how many states require an ultrasound test before. But I guarantee you that Virginia is not the only one. I don't think you can say that's religious.
Wait.
The issue.
Hold that thought for a second, because I do want to interject this. When we talk about these issues, we talk about the people that are coming out. For example, Secretary Sebelius, I think they're very much intertwined. Secretary Sebelius makes the mandate, says that religious organizations and your employer, you're going to have to provide contraception as part of your health care package. The people that came out against, not just the Catholic Church, you're talking about the Southern Baptist Convention, you're talking about the many religious organizations that came out and saying this goes against our religious beliefs.
Yes, I agree. That's why it's different. Abortion isn't just about religion. Abortion is a unique procedure that interrupts with the development of conception, the development of a fetus, and so on. Contraception basically says we do or do not believe that certain actions are legitimate and should be legal to allow people to control their decisions on whether or not to get pregnant. I'm a huge believer in family planning, and as you guys know, as far as I'm concerned, I'd like to find ways to make it not only universally accessible, but universally accessible at minimal cost. But what happened in the case of this administration, in their rule, which we can call it Secretary Sebelius's rule, but let's acknowledge that
she was the one who brought it forward. Let's be clear about that.
She had the power to do that. She basically said, religious organizations, we don't care what your view is on contraception, and there are some religious groups that are opposed to it, even though the overwhelming majority of America is for it, you must provide it to your employees. And that was the interference. That was the state telling a religious enterprise what it must or must not do on a religious matter. That's very different than what the state of Virginia
does. But you have to admit, though, that laws that are coming out, and it's not just here. There are other abortion rules that are being proposed in state legislatures, whether it's in Louisiana, South Carolina, Florida even, that are religious-based maneuvers to make state become part of that religious view. Bob, you heard Rick Santorum talk about the idea of religion should be infused as part of the way that our nation is governed.
Well,
and I'm paraphrasing. I am paraphrasing.
Yes, you are. Yeah.
Okay. Does that not scream of creating or taking away the separation of church and state?
First of all, let me say that I agree 100% with what Alan distinguished between them. I couldn't agree with him more. The fact of the matter is, though, that when the federal government or any state government, in effect, tells religious organizations what they can, what they have to do about that violates their beliefs, the government, whether it's a state government or a federal government, has gone too far. Period. There is no discussion in my mind. It's a wrong. It's a constitutional wrong. It's a violation of the Constitution, in my view.
But Bob, let me throw this question out there to you. When you look at, and you're saying that Alan's view of apples and oranges is correct. Remind yourself, legislation does not get developed unless there's somebody there telling the legislature, hey, we need this law. The ones that are pushing these laws are largely the ones who oppose Secretary Sebelius or the HHS ruling. These are the ones that are largely protesting in front of female health clinics. These are the same organizations. You see churches.
You are forgetting the organizations who are pushing the Sebelius position.
They prevailed. They're brief. But what I'm saying is, are we not seeing an influx of influence in the religious question as far as this country being governed and the rhetoric that's being put out there of late?
Well, I think it's true. I think it's pretty clear we are, and I don't think it's a very good idea. But, you know, look, most of the folks who are, let's get away from contraception, let's talk about abortion.
Okay.
Because that's what we're really talking about here.
Right. It's part of, I would say it's two different issues. They get all mixed up with each other. I disagree. They are separate issues.
Contraception is another question, but it's separate from abortion. Abortion is aborting a fetus. Contraception is avoiding having a fetus. Am I correct?
Absolutely.
But there's a distinction there.
Understanding the biological distinction. I understand the biological distinction, the medical distinction. But what we're talking about is legislation, whether it relates to abortion, and we talk about, you know, it was these religious organizations that prevailed, but it was still religious organizations influencing the way government governs the nation.
No question, but ultimately it's up to the American people to decide if this, these are the type of legislators they want.
Not if Rick Santorum has his way.
No,
that's correct. Rick Santorum's one guy. Even I don't care if he's president or not. He doesn't carry any votes with him.
No. Hey, listen.
And there will be backlash.
Absolutely. Senators and congressmen, they have enormous say here in what's in the law.
They have enormous things to say and have an enormous ability to write laws. But they cannot violate the First Amendment of the United States.
But if religious organizations have their way, whether it's the Catholic Church or the Southern Baptist Convention or the Church of Latter-day Saints, if they have their way, it is their religious position that influences the decision makers to make certain pieces of legislation or certain rulings, whether it's about abortion or contraception or the creche in front of City Hall or the Christmas lights. These are still religious influences that are driving these decisions.
Like any other interest group,
exactly.
You have power.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. And you have to check your power.
Just because you're a religious denomination doesn't mean you have to sit on the sidelines and not be heard.
No.
But there are conflicting voices among Christian groups, among all religions, on most of these issues.
Yeah.
It's not like there's any monolith out there.
No, it's just
another set of voices that have influence.
I couldn't agree more. When any church decides to go to Capitol Hill and argue one way or another for some of these issues, they are in effect saying, we would like our religious belief to become the law of the land. That has the same. It may be more important than you and me going up there and saying we got a point of view on something.
But the fact of the matter is, they are just, and
this is not a put down. They are another influence group speaking what they believe is a good idea to do in statute, and you can either take it or leave it alone.
Like the moral majority back in the early 80s.
Wait a minute. It's the moral majority. You want to talk about the moral majority. It's the religious right. That is driving a lot of what we're seeing today. It is a religious right. I mean, but going back to Bob's point, you can't tell me that Our Lady of the Sea Catholic Church, and I don't want to focus just on the Catholic Church because it could be a large denomination like First Baptist Church of Orlando or Church of Christ in Dallas. You can't tell me that the individual church itself, Our Lady of the Sea in New Smyrna Beach, Florida, could come up to Congress and say what HHS does is against the way we view the way that government should be involved. But when every archbishop and cardinal in the country goes up there, they wield a big stick of influence.
Yeah, they do.
Is that
so what?
Bleeding?
So what?
What?
So
what? Is that, does that not bleed?
No. Hey, look.
All right, let Bob and then Carl.
They are at that point, you know, an interest group, which is a legitimate, they have a right, like everybody else, to express their views, to, they have a right to seek a redress of grievance, if you will, which is a First Amendment right. They are just like a labor union. They're just like a bunch of crazy, wild-eyed liberal crazies who want to let anything happen they can do. That's fine. Everybody has a right to petition for grievance. No one has a right to say, we can say that you have to do what we want to do and make everybody else do it, because in effect that impinges on the right of free expression of religion.
So where does Santorum go astray, in your view, Bob?
When he opens his mouth.
Well put.
Right, or, okay, when he, or when he chooses to question the theology of the president and ascribe to the president religious views that he doesn't have, first of all.
All right,
that
let's
is
be
just
clear.
A danger area.
Let's be clear. Nobody at this table and nobody in this show has ever questioned the fact that the president of the United States, Barack Hussein Obama, is not a Christian. He is a Christian. He has he's gone to Christian churches his entire life. That's not in question. But the reality still dictates, though, is Rick Santorum is, in fact, putting out a stream of consciousness that religious organizations and the religious rights would, and the religious right would love to see, and that is bring religion back into the way that we, as a government, govern the individual elected.
That's his, yes, because his own personal, political, and religious views are all intertwined. There's no separation whatsoever.
And it appears to be a major problem for him. This whole thing reminds me that Franklin Graham, the son of Billy Graham, recently was on television on MSNBC, and not for the first time said, you know, I don't know if the president's a Christian or not. He says he is, so I guess I believe him. That prompted Chris Matthews to say, we need to keep Franklin Graham off the TV. Here's my proposal. Keep Franklin Graham off television if Chris Matthews also agrees to stay off television. How about
all right.
That?
There's nothing to be said about that. Cara.
The president has said a few times that if my parents knew that I was going to run for president, they wouldn't have given me the middle name Hussein. They didn't know. He stuck with the name. He's a Christian. He was born in Hawaii. And, you know, people who try to challenge that, I think, make fools of themselves to a degree.
But let's go back to the core issue. What we're bringing up is, in fact, the barrier between state and religion bleeding into one another.
Yeah.
I mean, this country has had a National Day of Prayer, which, by the way, this president has actively participated in.
Sure.
Does that not scream of religion having too much influence in the way that Americans are governed?
No.
Why?
No. Well, there is no one is required to pray. No one is required to go to the prayer breakfast. Nobody is required to believe any particular thing. It's just praying, and I think a whole lot of people pray in different ways. It's not a question of a particular religious prayer. I don't see anything wrong with saying, you know, a whole lot of us believe in a supreme being, and we may speak to him in different ways and follow different tenets which we believe he supports. But as long as it's not a federally mandated practice, it ain't a violation.
Well, I'll tell you what, we're going to let that be the last word on that subject. This is a subject I'm sure, judging from what we see and what we have coming out of the presidential primaries, this is something we're going to talk about again. And by the way, this makes really good radio, too. Kids, I got to tell you, it's now 5 minutes to the end of the show. And by the way, it's time for my favorite part of the show. It's time for Tell Me a Story. This is the part of the show where we talk about, hey, the rumor, buzz, conjecture that we're hearing around the Beltway, that we sometimes scoop the big, big media outlets. We know they're listening. So, going around the table, Alan, tell me a story.
All right. The hot news just the last few minutes is that Olympia Snow, in a big surprise, has said she will not run for re-election. And that's
whoa!
A
breaking news out of Washington.
Yes, indeed. That's a blow. That's
huge.
A blow for those who want to work across the aisle. On the religious issue, we didn't even get to the president's apology about the burning of the Quran, the Quran accidentally in Afghanistan. Very unfortunate event. I'm with the president on this, not with Gingrich. Sometimes you apologize because you need to protect the lives of your people and show respect to somebody else's religion. I don't see it countdowning or a point of weakness.
By the way, that Olympia Snow announcement, that tell me a story, that's got huge ramifications for the Republicans trying to maintain or gain the power in the leadership in the U.S. Senate.
You better believe it.
That's huge. Bob, tell me a story.
If Mr. Romney does not win tonight in his, quote, home state, unquote, we are going to have a continuing raucous and debilitating primary activity well beyond Super Tuesday.
We predicted it last week. We're saying that this fight goes all the way to Tampa. Are we going to have a contested... Republican convention.
I think it's too early to tell, but we are definitely not going to solve the problem in Super Tuesday.
Wow. Carl, since you're new, we're not going to hold you to tell me a story, but we're going to get you next time. Ralph, tell me a story.
Okay, Benjamin Netanyahu is going to be coming to D.C., and it's coming down to crunch time on how to address the nuclear issue with Iran. Obama's going to try and persuade Netanyahu that... he is wrong on the timetable of Iran getting the technology to develop nuclear weapons.
Interesting. I'm going to forego Mike telling a story. I do want to make one point. On behalf of everybody here at Backroom Politics and Blog Talk Radio, our thoughts and our prayers go out to the families and the victims of the school shooting out in Ohio yesterday. A really tragic scene. A really small community that really was hit hard. This affects them, and you never want to see that type of violence happen to people so young. Three young victims shot, their lives taken prematurely, and it's just what can only be classified as a indiscretionate act of violence amongst young people. Our thoughts and our prayers go out to them and to the community and out to the folks out in Ohio. Nothing good comes of that. I'm going to leave it at that. We're going to be back next week. Next Tuesday, 4 o'clock, we'll be back here at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in Washington, D.C. On behalf of Alan Moore, Bob Hines, Carl Tobin, Ralph Winnie, Congressman Al, please come back. We miss you.
We love you, Al.
This has been Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio from Washington, D.C. We'll see you next week. Thanks for joining us.